Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Earth Day, assessing the effects of the Trump administration on the Delaware River. Meg McGuire, editor and founder of Delaware Currents, talks about her editorial discussing the impacts of the Trump administration's policies on the Delaware River watershed. Faith in Action, a Beach Lake Earth Day event connecting spirituality with sustainability. In the latest episode of Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast, Bob Katz, host producer Brett Berry, speaks to wildlife veterinarian Jenny Bloodgood and Cornell graduate student Haley Turner about their collaborative research on New York's bobcat populations and the research connecting them with bird flu. Plus, the You Can Trust Yourself podcast. Stop wasting time asking for other people's advice. It's coming up. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Vatican says Pope Francis's funeral will be this Saturday. In his final Easter address, the pontiff called the situation in Gaza dramatic and deplorable after a year and a half of war. NPR's Anas Baba reports the Pope was a constant source of comfort to Gaza's Christians.
Up until his last moments, Pope Francis reached out and spoke up for Palestinians in Gaza. George Anton is a leader at the Holy Family Church, Gaza's only Catholic church. He said that the Pope called the congregation every evening, blessing them over speakerphone, asking if they had enough food or if they were safe in the church where they are sheltering from Israeli bombing. Anton said the last call was made the day before he died. How are you? Anton said the Pope asked, I'm praying for you. Pray for me. I need your prayers. Anton said, we feel orphaned now. The Pope was a shield for Christians in Gaza. Today, he said, less than 600 Christians remain in Gaza. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza City.
NPR has learned that the White House may be looking for a new defense secretary. That's after Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth used the messaging app Signal to share sensitive information about U.S. military strikes on Yemen, this time with his family. This is the second time Hegseth used the Signal chat to do this, and it was on a personal cell phone. Hegseth denies that any of the shared information was classified.
What was shared over Signal, then and now, however you characterize it, was informal, unclassified coordinations for media coordination and other things. That's what I've said from the beginning. At the beginning, it was left-wing reporters from The Atlantic who got a hold of it and then wanted to create a problem for the president. This is what it's all about, trying to get at President Trump and his agenda.
He spoke to Fox News. A note, NPR's CEO Catherine Marr is the chair of the board of the Signal Foundation, which supports the messaging app. Stocks opened higher this morning, regaining some of the ground lost in yesterday's sell-off. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped nearly 600 points in early trading.
The partial rebound in the stock market comes amid new warnings of economic fallout from President Trump's trade war. The International Monetary Fund predicts the combination of Trump's tariffs and economic uncertainty will cut into global growth this year. The IMF has downgraded its growth forecast for the United States by nearly a full percentage point. Economists say the trade war will lead to lower productivity and higher prices in the U.S. Trump wants the Federal Reserve to cushion the slowdown by lowering interest rates, but so far the central bank's been cautious for fear of rekindling inflation. Trump's attacks on Fed Chairman Jerome Powell have rattled financial markets, contributing to Monday's sharp drop in the stock market. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Harvard University is suing the Trump administration. This is to stop the White House from trying to freeze billions of dollars in federal funding. Harvard claims the administration is trying to control academic decision-making. Officials with Immigration and Customs Enforcement refused an urgent request from a former Columbia University graduate student to be with his wife in labor. ICE denied the request by Mahmoud Khalil. His wife delivered their son yesterday in New York. The Trump administration is trying to deport Khalil. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass is proposing to lay off more than 1,600 city employees. From LAist News, Frank Stoltz reports the mayor is trying to deal with a shortfall of nearly $1 billion.
The layoffs would likely cut across a wide swath of city departments, from recreation and parks to street services. They're necessitated in part because of last year's big pay raises for city employees, which will add about $250 million in costs to next year's budget. As costs have increased, revenues are headed down because of the weakening economy. City officials are predicting President Trump's trade tariffs are likely to make things even worse. The Los Angeles City Council must approve a budget by June 1st. For NPR News, I'm Frank Stoltz in Los Angeles.
The Department of Homeland Security says a thief stole the purse of Secretary Kristi Noem on Sunday night. She was at a Washington, D.C. restaurant having dinner with her family. She's lost her passport, agency badge, and about $3,000 in cash. Again on Wall Street, the Dow's now up 1.5%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. It's Earth Day, and we're going to talk about the Delaware River. It winds through four states, providing drinking water to over 14 million people. But as Meg McGuire of Delaware Currents writes in her current editorial, the river and the communities that depend on it are now navigating murky waters of a different kind. Political uncertainty, funding chaos, and environmental rollbacks under the Trump administration. Meg McGuire is joining us now to talk about what she's hearing on the ground, what's at risk, and why so many people are afraid to speak out. Meg, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. I think, let me tackle the last one first, because I want us to respect the folks that don't speak out, because you don't want to be in the crosshairs. Very often these executive orders come down and they can be fairly fuzzy. But if you're head and shoulders above the rest, it could be directed directly at your organization. And if you're a leader of an organization, you have a commitment to that organization. You want that work to continue, and you don't want to necessarily attract attention that would cause cuts or freezing of funding. In addition, you have the responsibility of staff. I mean, there are people that are relying on you to pay their mortgage, and the caution is, I tend to be like, give people a wide latitude right now, because we are only people doing the best job we can against an administration that is hell-bent on chaos. And the fact that there are some people that feel the best approach is a protective crouch, fine. That's fine with me. We will try and do our best to understand what's going on with the folks that are more comfortable speaking out.
In this editorial for Delaware Currents, you dive into the fog of fear, silence, and stalled progress that's clouding the environmental work in the watershed. And when you say fog, it's not meteorological. It's emotional and bureaucratic. What does that fog look like for people living and working in the watershed?
Well, because it affects so many people in different ways. In this particular essay, report, whatever, I highlighted four areas just to sort of see how complicated things can be for people, right? But the sort of litany I wrote in the very beginning, the anxiety stems from what's happening to legal and otherwise immigrants, what jobs both federal and private sector could disappear if funding for them comes even partially from the feds, and what higher tariffs could mean to our ports on the Delaware, as well as everybody who wants to sell anything that's imported from anywhere. Then it's in the academic community, it's in the public radio and TV community, right? The LGBT community and veterans and retirees. It's just a plethora of orders and counterorders and freezes, lawyers taking people to the federal government to court, judges having say-so on what happens, the administration playing reindeer games with those judges. I mean, it's really quite amazing. And when I think of this, I think of the chaos and think that that might be really what's, if you have 1,000 different things to be worried about, it's almost impossible to put your arms around any one of them and to focus on something and to make a difference in that something, you know? So, it's just, it's an unprecedented an unprecedented era and an era of challenge for our system of government, I think.
What are some of the most significant rollbacks or federal actions that could directly affect the health of the Delaware River watershed?
Well, I started by talking about the state revolving funds. This is something that, you know, almost no one knows about, cares about, whatever. It's a process where federal money gets, according to, you know, Clean Water Act sort of stipulations and stuff like that, it's very targeted towards the water community. These state revolving funds go to the states, and then the states divvy them out to the folks that need them. In the Delaware River watershed, obviously much less so in your neck of the wood because the water is wonderful, but as soon as you get south of Trenton, the water is less wonderful. And there has been an ongoing effort by the Delaware River Basin Commission to understand what is the problem with the water and how do we find a solution. And one of the solutions may very well involve each of the wastewater treatment plants in this top tier going to their state revolving funds and getting long-term, low-interest loans to create the multi-million dollar tertiary treatments that the water coming out of our sewage treatment plants can be in better shape for the river. So it's like you have to sort of follow this path way back. And what happens with these low-interest loans is that Philadelphia Water, for example, or the Wilmington folks, or the people in Trenton or in Camden, they borrow the money, and because they can borrow it at low interest, it doesn't have as much impact on their communities. Because one of the important things to remember is that communities like, especially Philly and Camden, they are not well off. They do not have deep pockets. And so the only way they can resolve some of these things is with some outside help. So it's not just, obviously, in the watershed. In all four states, there are issues about the state revolving funds and whether they'll be there for people to borrow from.
And also, when you talk about these, when you talk about the state revolving funds and how vital they are for infrastructure, it's kind of a technical thing, as you mentioned. But there are other technical issues, like dissolved oxygen standards.
Oh yes.
Can you talk about that and
our
why
old friend?
why the average resident should care about that too?
In the Delaware River, there is an endangered species, a fairly ugly fish called the sturgeon. And that species is at a very low point in its population. And as endangered species, we try and protect whatever we have of these species. With the dissolved oxygen being low in certain areas of the Delaware, The young of year have a problem thriving, right? You may get some hatching, right? But you don't necessarily get a thriving population. So the government machinery, as you full well know, grinds slowly. Maybe 13 years ago, the Delaware Riverkeeper was among the first to sort of shout the alarm for the fate of the sturgeon. The DRBC eventually lumbered into action, and about 10 years ago, maybe a little more, they started to explore the issue of dissolved oxygen to be able to actually specifically say, where is the problem coming from? And dissolved oxygen is the oxygen that fish need in the water. But if your waste is not completely processed, that processing that will happen in the river that can happen, and it's perfectly natural for it to happen, overwhelms the river, and the result is a reduction in the dissolved oxygen that the fish need in order to survive. These fish are fish that travel through areas of the river in order to go upstream and then come back downstream when mating and hatching is over, and they then end up going back out to the ocean. So that passage is impeded. And let's face it, when the river doesn't have the right amounts of dissolved oxygen, it can't really be called a healthy river. So it's not really a great thing for humans that the river is not as healthy as it could be.
Let's talk about the National Park Service. That seems to be a microcosm of the broader federal upheaval. What is your take on how staffing cuts there and reorganizations could ripple through the communities in the watershed?
I think there are people in the National Park Service who are dedicated professionals who love their jobs, who will lose their jobs. I think there are people who are taking buyouts. I certainly would, because the government offered a buyout and said, well, you can take the buyout or you can keep the job. But if you keep the job, we're not guaranteed that the job is going to be there. So since Trump took office, there has been one edict after another affecting all federal employees. In the case of the National Park Service, they have an advocacy group called the National Parks Conservation Association, which is allowed to talk about this stuff in a way that the National Park Service is not. No federal employee has permission, air quotes, to talk about hiring and firing. The National Parks Conservation Association is doing an incredible job trying to let people know what's actually happening in a step-by-step process. In the story that you referenced, there's like, there's probably 10, 11 different important dates, but there is one big shoe that is still, everyone's still waiting for, which is that the Park Service had to submit new org charts and proposals for relocating staff and offices, potential contract cancellations, and staff reductions to the administration. And it's sometime now that the result of those proposals will be promulgated and then tell the public. So we are waiting. We who live next door to the parks, enjoy the parks, certainly benefit from the economic vitality that they bring to the area, right? We still don't know how badly it could be cut. The other thing that I wanted to say about the National Park Service, something that I didn't really understand until I started doing Delaware Currents, is what a depth of knowledge they have about the ecosystem that is the river. Like how warm water affects the ecosystem, what fish go where. They've been involved in plastic studies. They are deeply involved in the understanding, certainly, of the upper river. And that knowledge walks out the door. That ability to understand what's going on in the river and perhaps do something about it walks out the door. We still don't know how this is all going to be affecting, I mean, the two major parks in our neck of the woods. But this litany of cuts applies also to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, right? That's also a federal outfit. But we can't see into the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service because they don't have this advocacy voice. And like it's a bit embarrassing for us as people who enjoy the parks. The reason why the National Park Service end up with the National Park Conservation Association is that they have been perennially underfunded. And so the Park Service itself can't mow for contributions from people like me and the people who can maybe afford even more than I can, but the Conservation Association can. So it exists, it pre-existed this nonsense because of the underfunding of the Park Service. And now it becomes the mouthpiece for the Park Service, but also starts to represent the incredible chaos that's through every federal agency that you can possibly imagine. I was reading today, Lord love us, I can't remember the name of it. There's a federal organization that's in charge of libraries, and libraries are going to have a cut in their federal funding. So one of the ways that we will be affected is you might not have the same level of staffing at your local library. They may not be able to borrow what they have previously been able to borrow in order to buy books. There's these enormous amounts of ripple effects that sometimes, honestly, I'm sure, is overwhelming. And one of the things that I'm still trying to get my arms around is there something in all of these cuts, in all of these activities, that is incredibly important to me, that I can put my shoulder to the wheel, not so much as Delaware Currents, because I'm a 501c3 and I shouldn't be, you know, advocating, but in my private life, is there something that I can do that in my community, I can affect the sorts of change that can counteract this chaos? I mean, one of the things that I've always admired about Sullivan County is, you know, they get the bit between their teeth and they make things happen. They haven't been successful in their drive to preserve the Skinner's Falls Bridge, but my word, what grassroots community action has been generated by the concern about that bridge. And it's that, like, in my neighborhood, what can I do that somehow buoys up people who might be in problems, having problems or suffering, organizations that I believe in that might be having problems, something that I can do that sort of, but certainly my 5 cents is a drop in the bucket, but it's that activity at that local level that can, I think, perhaps make people feel a little less despairing.
Well, the community certainly rallied around the fracking issue. That's resurfaced in a big way. We don't have a lot of time to get into that right now. But what gives you hope right now? Is it that resilience and resistance of the community that make you optimistic?
Optimistic might be too strong a word. I reach for optimism, and that is my muscle when I reach. Is that sense that I don't think that we are ineffectual. I don't think that we can't achieve things. I don't know that we will always be successful. I mean, the advocacy against fracking was an amazing thing. That was watershed wide. And that might need to be called into action again, right? I mean, the Delaware River Keeper and a lot of the other advocacy organizations are already, you know, they're already sounding the trumpets on this. And I don't know, like, there's so many activities that the administration is involved in that is being blocked by courts. And then there's this weird dance that the courts and the administration are doing about whether they can undo the, like, the that poor man in Maryland, you know? I mean, everybody admits, oh, yeah, sorry, that was a mistake, but we can't bring him back. What? What? With federal judges saying you have to bring him back and the administration shrugging their shoulders. So there's so many reasons to be depressed and to be concerned and want to sort of crawl under a rock until perhaps the midterms or even the next presidential election. But I really do believe the promise lies in the communities that we build that support each other. And even if it's, you know, even if it's small things, something that helps people see that they are not alone.
Meg McGuire is the founder and publisher of Delaware Current. You can read her latest essay, Assessing the Effects of the Trump Administration on the Delaware River Watershed, at DelawareCurrents.org. Meg, thank you very much. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day to you too, Tim. Thanks.
All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, talk about faith and sustainability. That's coming up after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, there is no sludgier place in America than Washington, D.C.
There are lots and lots of people in government whose jobs are to make sure something doesn't happen.
But there are some signs of change.
Have we hit peak sludge? I don't know. I hope so.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, Earth Day is more than just a call to care for the planet. It's also a chance to reflect on our deeper connection to creation and the responsibility we share as stewards of the Earth. In Beech Lake, Pennsylvania, Friday Friends United Women in Faith is marking the occasion with a special community event at the Beech Lake United Methodist Church. It blends environmental action with spiritual purpose. Joining us today is Allison Francesco, National Director of United Women in Faith and one of the event's organizer, to share how the gathering is more than just about going green. It's about living out spiritual values through a care for creation. Allison, hello.
Good morning. Happy Earth Day.
Well, happy Earth Day. Tell us a little bit about Friday Friends United Women in Faith and your role within the group and how you approach faith and spirituality in connection with environmental issues and sustainability.
Well, first and foremost, we're a group of friends who gathered and said that we wanted to do something more for our local community, as well as connect with United Women in Faith organizations all around the country. So we're a dynamic group of women, interdenominational. We're not all from Beach Lake United Methodist, but we come together because we support United Women in Faith. They're an organization that has been around, for 150 plus years. There are units within churches and within communities all over the world. And we definitely support anything that, for the betterment of women, children, and youth. And one of the primary goals of United Women in Faith is to enable us all to be stewards of God's creation. And it's part of the social principles of the United Methodist Church. It does state that we should be stewards of what God has given us, God's creation. And United Women in Faith have a climate justice program. They say women are disproportionately affected by climate change issues, which is something that not everyone realizes. And, of course, we know what happens in our local communities, but we don't always see beyond that. So in our, I guess, in our desire to connect with our community and to support local organizations like Victims Intervention Program, our food pantries, and many other outreaches, we knew it was important that we talk about Earth Day. And so we are sponsoring this event on Saturday, rain or shine, at Beach Lake to come celebrate Earth Day with us, learn a little bit more about what it means to be a steward of God's creation.
What can folks expect at this event on Saturday, Earth Day today, but you guys are celebrating on Saturday, hoping to attract some more people on the weekend. Yeah. What can folks expect there?
Well, we're going to just have a friendly, informal gathering where you can come, you can plant your own seeds, and we have recyclable pots. We're having a seed exchange table. One of our members, Kimberly Protzman, is also a master gardener with Penn State Cooperative Extension. So she's got some good connections with seeds, and she has a vast knowledge that we are definitely tapping into for this event. And we're going to share about climate justice issues. We also have a community garden at Beach Lake. We will have information there, and we're hoping the weather is going to cooperate. I mean, we're having it rain or shine, but it would be great if people could go and look at our community garden, which is located in the back of the property in Beach Lake at 7 Mylandville Road behind the church. So, and we're hoping some people from the community garden are going to be there so they can also show the community the unique opportunity that people have to be involved with that garden as well.
Earth Day is all about taking action for the planet. What's one simple thing you hope people will take away from your event and carry into their everyday lives?
Well, I think it's simple to do things every day that show care and concern for the earth. I mean, recycling is something simple. For some of us in rural areas, it's not always easy to recycle because we don't have anyone picking up our recyclables, but we can do that. Interestingly enough, the little pots we're using are actually cereal containers that I teach at Wall and Fallback, and I have students who have been collecting these, and they are donating them to me to show that even simple things can be used again and repurposed. So the cereal container is going to house some beautiful seeds that are going to grow into plants, and we're also going to show people, you know, I let everyone plant their little plant and give them care and instruction on how to take it and what are next steps. You know, that we can all make a difference in our community by simply recycling, by planting, by taking care of those things that God has given us. They're gifts, and we need to care for them.
Before we go, what does Earth Day personally mean to you, both spiritually and practically?
Well, I take the mandate of being a steward of God's creation seriously, and my husband and I are parents of two young adults who are both very passionate about the environment. And, you know, we've, as a family, have made a commitment to try to live sustainably and to not abuse the environment and to do what we can to make it a better place. So even something as simple as planting a garden or a pot on your deck if you don't have a big yard, just, you know, little steps and things that we can do just to make our community better and to take care of one another and to share what we know and what we have.
Okay, before we wrap up, let's remind listeners where they can get more information about the Saturday event.
Well, you can go to Beach Lake United Methodist Church's website, which is www.beachlakeunc.susumc.org. We also have a Facebook page, and we're on Instagram. And you can also call the church office, 570-729-7011. But join us on Saturday the 26th from 10 a.m. until noon. Rain or shine, we will be there because the weather is looking a little iffy. But
yeah.
You'll see, we'll have tents on the front or from the front lawn, and then we'll have a door open into our fellowship hall in case the weather is not cooperating. But it would love to stop by, enjoy some music, have some refreshments, and bring some seeds, take some seeds, and plant your pot.
And care more about the earth and keep Earth Day going. Allison Francesco is the National Director of United Women in Faith, and they have that event coming up Saturday at Beach Lake United Methodist Church, blending environmental action with spiritual purpose. Allison, thanks so much for joining us, and happy Earth Day.
Oh, happy Earth Day, and thank you very much for having me.
All right. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Lions, Bears, and Bobcats. Oh, my. A Cats Cast. The latest episode is a preview next on Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Cats Cast is the Catskills podcast, and host producer Brett Berry is speaking to wildlife veterinarian Jenny Bloodgood and Cornell graduate student Haley Turner in this episode to discuss their collaborative research on New York's bobcat populations. Brett's joining us now. Brett, what's up with the bobcats?
Hey, Tim. Good morning. Well, there is a call for a kind of a count or a census on New York's bobcats and to see what the health of the population and the abundance of bobcats are. And in the process of this research, they're able to find out a lot of other things. While they have the opportunity to anesthetize and collar these bobcats, they can take other samples and figure out how these cats are doing. So Cornell is partnering with the New York State DEC to come up with some of this data.
Well, they look cute, but I'm not sure I want to be the one counting these bobcats. What are we going to hear in this excerpt from the latest Cats Cast episode?
Yeah, so the bobcats are trapped professionally, so you don't have to just, you know, yank them from the wild. And once they are safely anesthetized, they're collared and they're sampled for blood and feces and other biological markers to see what kind of pathogens or diseases they're up against and how they're fighting them off. So that was kind of the other half of this research. The bombshell news here, and I'll just spoiler alert here, bird flu is something that bobcats are susceptible to. So they enjoy birds. That's one of the things that they eat, and this may be a problem.
Mm-hmm. All right, here's the latest episode, an excerpt from that of Cats Cast, talking about bobcats and research underscoring the important issue of monitoring and understanding the health and habitat challenges these elusive felines face. Here's Brett. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, so far we've tested 16 animals from the first season. 9 out of 16 had been exposed to some sort of avian influenza virus.
That's Jenny Bloodgood, wildlife veterinarian at the Cornell Wildlife Health Lab. She's been collaborating with Cornell graduate student Haley Turner, who's researching the abundance of New York's bobcats. GPS collar tagging is one aspect of that effort, and with an anesthetized bobcat in hand, the team is taking advantage of that opportunity to collect biological samples. On today's show, Bloodgood and Turner revealed their findings, including the recent discovery of avian influenza, bird flu, in New York's wild bobcats.
I am Jenny Bloodgood. I'm a veterinarian with the Wildlife Health Program for New York State. So I work with the Cornell Wildlife Health Lab, which is half of the partnership that makes up the Wildlife Health Program. And the other half is the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation.
So my name is Haley Turner. I am in the second year of my master's at Cornell University. I am in the Department of Natural Resources and Environment. And I've been working on a project that's funded by the Department of Environmental Conservation. So I've been working on estimating abundance of bobcats for the past 2 years.
Yeah, so with our partnership with the Department of Environmental Conservation, we really focus on native New York wildlife health. So we do general surveillance for diseases or other things that may affect wildlife health. And we monitor trends in those diseases to identify potential emerging threats to populations or just keep track of ongoing threats.
How did bobcats take the stage here? What drew you to researching bobcats of all of the wildlife that we have here in the state?
The DEC had this objective of understanding the abundance of bobcats in New York State. And so once I was tasked with this project, I looked into the veterinary college here to see who I could rely on for help with this project, because we specifically had an aspect where we were deploying GPS collars on bobcats, and that was a component of estimating their abundance. And so this is something that I had never done before, where I physically handled animals, and so wanted to have a licensed and experienced veterinarian on the project. So I reached out to Jenny, who was very excited to work on the project, and said, hey, I have all these ideas of biological samples that we could collect while we're working on bobcats.
So the larger research is about bobcat abundance in New York State?
Correct.
Can you tell me a little bit, Haley, about the history of bobcat populations as you know it and how that's changed over the years and why reevaluate it now?
Absolutely. So bobcats were nearly extirpated from New York by the 1970s. There was unregulated harvest, and in fact, the government considered them a nuisance species. And so there were actual bounties placed on bobcats, and when trappers would harvest a bobcat, they'd turn it in and they would receive payment for that. And so by the 1970s, the strongholds of bobcats in New York were in the Catskills, in the Taconic region, and in the Adirondacks. And so since then, bobcats have been recolonizing some areas of New York State. However, the DEC has used harvest totals, so that's total number of bobcats harvested each year, to basically have an index of abundance where they look at how many bobcats are harvested and figure out what the population is looking like. So we created this project to be able to finally estimate bobcat abundance not using harvest-based indices.
So explain how you're doing it.
The primary component is we put out about 329 camera trap stations across New York State, and that's in 5 different study areas. And a camera station consists of 2 trail cameras, some people call them game cameras, where they're just passively monitoring the animals that walk by. And so we have all these stations where we've got cameras facing each other, and that's so that we can get a good look at both sides of the bobcat, because bobcats actually have distinct inner leg bars on their bodies, which we can tell the individual bobcat from, and that goes into our abundance model. Additionally, we put out a short distance scent lure in between those 2 cameras, so that if a bobcat or any other animal that's walking by is, say, within 50 feet of the cameras, they might smell that scent and then get curious, and maybe increases the chances that they come to check it out and we get a photo of them. Bobcats are very much like domestic cats in that they love shiny things. So we actually would also hang CDs from trees that would potentially get their attention if it glinted off of the sunlight or moonlight. And so we just targeted bobcats for this species, but I will say we had a ton of bycatch species that we caught on camera as well. And so that was the first component. And then the second component, as I mentioned, was deploying these GPS collars on bobcats. And so we have 2 summers worth of this camera trap data where we collected images over summer 2024 and summer 2023. And then we put out GPS collars on bobcats in winter of 2024 and winter of 2025.
What does the collar I don't know if it's a does or do, because we're talking about data. What do the collar data tell you?
We put these collars out in the winter when we were doing the trapping. And we first just had the collars during that winter season collecting one location fix per day. So every day the collar would collect the location of the bobcat at that precise time. And then starting April 1st, those collars switched to collecting a location fix every 2.5 hours. We did this because we wanted to save battery on the collars so that they would last during our survey period. And so the data that we're getting from these collars is fine scale movement on how those bobcats are moving during our camera trap period, because we want to know how bobcats theoretically would be moving across our camera trap arrays. It's just part of a movement scale parameter, essentially, that gets put into our abundance model.
So let's now talk about what else you've discovered through this research. It gave you the opportunity not only to tag a number of these animals, but also to test them. What kind of tests are you running and what has that shown?
Yeah, so we've been really fortunate to be able to tag onto this project. Like Haley mentioned, I'm always, if we're going to be sedating an animal for something, we should go ahead and collect as many biological samples as we can and learn about the animal's health. So we collected blood on everybody.
What came back in those blood tests?
We looked for cytoxoan felis, which is a protozoal disease of cats. That's where the name felis comes from. We also looked for feline leukemia virus, which you may have heard from domestic cats, Toxoplasma gondii, and then we looked for canine distemper virus, parvovirus, and avian influenza virus. So we kind of ran the gamut here, and the way that we chose these things was looking at things that we know can impact bobcat health in other areas, like potentially canine distemper virus or parvovirus, emerging things that are really interesting going on in the environment right now, like avian influenza virus, and then some other things that potentially could be shared between domestic cats and bobcats, or even between bobcats and people.
What made you decide to test for avian flu? Obviously, a bobcat is not a bird. You must have had some suspicion that they would be susceptible to it.
Yes. So our lab, the Wildlife Health Lab, in our partnership with DEC, has been following avian influenza, this current outbreak of the H5N1 strain, since it came to North America. The first detection in the U.S. was in late 2021, and we first detected it in New York State in early 2022. We first detected it in a mammal also in early 2022. It was actually April, I believe, and it was a red fox. But then this virus has continued to kind of evolve and what's called spill over, going from its sort of normal avian hosts to a mammal host. It has spilled over many times into mammals, lots of wildlife. So if you go on to the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA website, you can see all the many different mammal species that have been infected with avian influenza. We were interested to see, bobcats, we know that they do eat birds. And based on what Haley told us earlier, they spend time in wetlands. And carriers of avian influenza virus are typically waterfowl, so your ducks and your geese. So that sort of habitat overlap, and then also the dietary preferences of bobcats, could predispose them to avian influenza infection. So that was why we set out to look for antibodies to avian influenza in our animals.
And how many did you find that were either actively infected or, judging from antibodies, had had it in the past?
Yeah, so far we've tested 16 animals. We're waiting on a second set from our second season of testing, so it'll be interesting to see the updated numbers and how that could have changed through time. But of the 16 animals we tested from the first season, 9 out of 16 had been exposed to some sort of avian influenza virus. So there's a more generalized test that looks for antibodies to influenza A virus in general, which avian influenza is. And then there's more specific ones where you can actually look at antibodies to those particular proteins, the H5 and the N1 in this case. So in our animals, we had 4 that had been exposed specifically to H5N1. And the interesting thing is, I'm saying exposed because we looked at antibodies in these animals and we had them in hand to be putting the collars on them for Haley's study. And they were healthy animals, seemingly healthy animals. So they had been exposed and been able to survive that exposure. But we did have one animal that after collaring it and it being healthy and antibody free for avian influenza, after about 5 weeks, it died. So Haley got a what's called a mortality signal on the collar. So she knew it had died and went out to collect the collar and the animal. And she was able to find the animal and retrieve her collar. And she brought the animal to the Animal Health Diagnostic Center, which is where I work at the vet school with the Wildlife Health Lab. And we were able to do what's called a necropsy, which is the animal version of an autopsy, to figure out why the animal died. So we worked with one of our pathologists, Dr. Gavin Hitchner, on that. And he was able to determine that the bobcat died from avian influenza. And it had only been 5 weeks since we had sampled the animal, and it had not been exposed at that time. So that means that it got avian influenza in that five-week period and died from it very quickly.
So based on these numbers from this sample, do you see avian influenza as a major threat or just one of many pathogens that these cats are already dealing with?
I think we don't know yet. The way that the study works and the number of animals we trapped and were able to get our hands on, it's really almost impossible to say without a multi-year study following the same animals or trapping almost every bobcat in the state. So we know that out of the 16 we were able to sample and test, that 9 were exposed to influenza viruses, 4 were H5N1. But we don't really know how that extrapolates to the population as a whole. But we do know that the one animal died from it, so it is a pathogen of concern that can kill bobcats. We do know that multiple animals survived infection, too, because the collar data was still going months and months after we sampled them, and they had antibodies, so we know that they lived for months and months at a minimum. So that's important, too, to realize that bobcats can fight off infection and go on to live a theoretically normal life. So I kind of see it as one in a set of many. So we looked at basically everything our entire group could come up with. We were like, what could infect a bobcat and what could, you know, affect their population? And we came up with this list of diseases to look at. And, you know, we found exposure to a lot of different things. So I think just knowing that bobcats are facing a lot of different challenges, not only from habitat loss and climate change and things that all animals are facing, but also some of these diseases as well, including emerging infectious diseases that are zoonotic and of one health importance, meaning that they are important to animal, human, and environmental health.
These creatures get so many diseases and often are very hardy and probably a lot hardier than we are, but do get sick and die from these kind of hot button viruses that we hear about.
That's a good point. I feel like bobcats and just other wildlife in general are so much tougher than people. They can really handle a lot and still make it in life. So it's pretty impressive.
We'd be out on some of these captures just shivering
yeah.
and thinking, these Bobcats live out here, and we are all with our hot hands in our pockets, just really cold.
Bobcat populations struggled in the early 20th century, primarily due to unregulated hunting practices and bounties paid on the misguided perception of bobcats as a nuisance species. Legal safeguards were implemented in the 1970s, including the Federal Endangered Species Act and statewide regulations on hunting and trapping. Many thanks to Haley Turner and Jenny Bloodgood, and to Garth Avery, who engineered our recording session from Cornell's broadcast studios. For CatsCast and WJFF Radio Catskill, this is Brett Barry.
And you can hear that full episode of CatsCast, the CatsCast podcast, at catscast.com. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn more about how you can stop listening to everyone's advice. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, Suave Season 1 won a Pulitzer. Suave Season 2 is coming up, and we give you a preview. Life after more than 30 years in prison.
I just feel sometimes that being free is not what everybody think it is. It's really not.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And last week we introduced you to a podcast that's new to us, but it's been around for a little bit. It is You Can Trust Yourself with Meg and Maggie. That's Megan Spencer and Maggie Fitzpatrick. Maggie is a coach that you've heard here before who specializes in optimizing mental and physical human performance. And Megan is a clinical mental health therapist in training. Megan utilizes modalities through person-centered theory and specializes in anxiety. They're both here today to talk about their latest episode of You Can Trust Yourself. Stop listening to everyone's advice. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's dive right in. Your latest episode touches on a behavior many of us can relate to, asking everyone else what to do. What inspired this topic? Megan?
Oh, yes. Hi. Wanted to make sure Maggie wasn't going to jump in there. Yes. Yeah, so this topic is one that is always on deck for us because it ties so much into our mission of nurturing our ability to trust ourselves. And this is a really common thing that so many of us do. I even find myself doing it from time to time of constantly seeking advice outside of ourselves. And the issue that arises with that is that it takes us further and further away from trusting ourselves.
And you talk about outsourcing your power. Can you break that down for listeners a little bit who might be new to that concept, and what does it look like in everyday life?
Yeah, absolutely. So as Meg was saying, when we're constantly asking people for advice, it's not actually the advice that is bad that we shouldn't be listening to, right? Where we run into trouble is when we take that advice at face value and we don't filter it through what we actually want. Right? So, Tim, I might ask you a question. What do you think I should have for lunch? Right? And when you think about lunch, you're thinking about your food preferences, mm-hmm. what you want, what fits into your nutrition guidelines, right? And those things might align with me or they might not, right? And mm-hmm. when I just take advice from other people as exactly what they said and I don't filter it through what is important to me and what my values are, this concept of outsourcing our power comes in because now someone else is actually making that decision. We don't have the power to make that decision anymore because we just gave it away to someone else, mm-hmm. right? So it's not actually asking other people that's the issue. It's when we don't consider our own needs and desires in combination with that information.
Megan, you mentioned about societal norms pushing us toward seeking validation. What do you think are some small ways people can begin to push back against that and start building some trust in themselves today?
This is such a good question, and I'm experiencing this in real time as I have a new BFF called ChatGPT, and I have been using that like crazy. And so in real time over here in my life in little ways, I've had to really have some quiet like moments with myself of literally just checking in and being like, okay, Meg, you're getting quite a few ideas from this beautiful machine here. And I think some of the simple ways that we can do this is we are all about practice on our show. There is no room for perfectionism over here. We are trying our best to nurture our ability to trust ourselves. And so practicing with little things, like Maggie said, of what sounds good for lunch today, or, you know, do I want to go for a walk or do I want to go to the workout class? Asking ourselves small questions can kind of build up that evidence and almost like strengthen that muscle of self-trust. And so those little decisions is really when we can practice being able to trust ourselves and listening to our own wants.
What do you think, Maggie, is the first step to tuning into that inner voice again? Trust yourself.
Yeah, going back to that self-trust starter pack episode, actually, that we talked about last week, I think one of the first things is pause, is silence, right? So Viktor Frankl says the moment between stimulus and response is where our power lies, right? And whether it is something that is going on outside of us or a question that we are asking ourselves, if we can take a moment to pause, that is the opportunity for us to tune in to listening to ourselves, right? When we move so quickly and we go from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, we don't have an opportunity to hear, right? And some people might actually hear their intuition like through their ear. Some people might feel it in their gut. I'm kind of more of a feeling person where when I am considering something, I will feel if it's a yes or a no. I don't necessarily hear it, but some people might hear it. But I can't feel it or hear it if I don't pause, right? And so for me, that is one of the like most foundational things.
This seems such a relevant episode for the time we're living in, especially where everybody has an opinion or a platform or both. What do you hope listeners walk away with after hearing this episode? Megan?
Hope that they are able to kind of walk away from it from knowing that we're not, you know, shaming advice. There's nothing wrong with, I mean, Maggie and I both have mentors and I require supervision in my clinical field. And so there's nothing wrong with advice, kind of similar to what Maggie's saying. We want our listeners to walk away with, we're going to hear other people's opinions. We know that. There's no stopping the noise, right? And we also have the power to say, yeah, but I have a really strong internal system that can filter out this. And so that's something that if they can take that away from this episode, which they will, this is something that can be really, really powerful.
Maggie?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I think that if you just feel a little bit more inspired and believe a little bit more that you can do it, that's really our goal from this episode, because it can feel really overwhelming when we get into this cycle of feeling like we have to outsource our ideas or our decisions, or like you said, constantly seek that external validation. So a little bit of inspiration and a little bit more belief in ourselves.
When you also mentioned that trusting yourself can actually improve your relationships and just overall well-being, let's remind folks again who are new to the You Can Trust Yourself podcast where they can find it.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find our show. The most popular platforms are Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or if you want to watch us while listening, you can find us on YouTube as well.
And I think, and I'm double checking here, that we put it up on our website as well under our, yeah, Community Voices podcast. So if you go to wjffradio.org, click on shows, there's a drop down menu, click podcasts, you'll scroll down to our Community Voices podcast, and there you will see You Can Trust Yourself with Megan and Maggie. Thank you guys so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, lots of other things at our website as well, wjffradio.org. You can find our new Curtain Call podcast from Tom Candela talking about local theater. It's at wjffradio.org. And before we go, a special shout out to Mimi Bradley for helping line up the phone calls on today's show. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey there, I'm Jason Dole, reminding you that public media is under serious threat. Efforts to eliminate federal funding could disrupt everything that you rely on from Radio Catskill. These funds help us provide listeners like you with crucial information, from life-saving emergency alerts to local news. But if federal funding vanishes, we could lose all these essential community services. The stakes have never been higher. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org and tell Congress to protect Radio Catskill while there's still time.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Nat King Cole goes Latin.
a trip to Disney's Adventureland, and the new exotic sounds of the Voodoo Five. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Why not join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred? The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, warmer for the next few days, a high of 65 today, low tonight 40, sunny and pleasant tomorrow 66, Thursday sunny and warm and a high of 71, up to 74 on Friday. On Point is next from WBUR Boston. It's 11 o'clock.